My name's Michelle Karpinko, and we're going to talk this afternoon about Jobbers, a new philosophy for an old phenomenon. And I'd like to share with you this afternoon from my own background of being a childbirth educator for now about 11 years, and a physical therapist of about 13 years, and a mother of three. And I think the last criteria is the most important one, actually. I would like to invite you to ask questions or give comments anywhere along the way, because I think you all, in your own way, can bring a wealth of information to the topic we're going to talk about. I had actually hoped that we'd have some grandmas in the group this afternoon, because that's really fun to have grandmas around. But it looks like we have some perspective, some who've had and some who in the future may. So it's kind of a nice variety as it is. Birth, having a baby. You know, it's as old as man and woman themselves, and yet it's as much a miracle and a sign of God's creative force at work as ever. Yet in the last approximately 20 years, the attitudes and expectations surrounding childbirth, the medical treatment of it, the personal understanding and participation in it has radically changed. Those of us who've had children in the last 12 years, especially, have been exposed to and reaped the benefits of a new philosophy and approach to childbirth. Gone, or at least far removed, are the images of Charlotte O'Hara writhing in her bed, screaming in pain, in Gone with the Wind. And if you haven't seen the movie, then it dates me even more. Even Aunt Millie's stories, or whoever supplied your own personal library of passed-on birth stories, are being demystified and put into proper perspective by knowledge and understanding. Lamaze has become a household word, and evidences of it pop up in numerous TV shows, Happy Days and Archie Bunker included. How many of you, in fact, have taken Lamaze or some other form of childbirth preparation? To get a sense of progression and change, all I have to do is look at my own three births and the options and circumstances that surrounded each of them. That starts about 11 years ago. And when we had our first child, we found ourselves in a small Nebraskan town. And it meant traveling 25 miles to Lincoln, the state capital, to find a hospital that was open to husbands being in the delivery room. It meant traveling the same 25 miles one way once a week to find any classes to go to, because at that time in Nebraska, there were only classes offered in Omaha and in Lincoln. We were fortunate enough to find a hospital that was new and was family-centered, which meant that we did have a lot of immediate contact with our little son when he was born. I was able to room in with him, and that was really a very pleasurable experience. Our middle child was born almost 9 years ago in our local hospital in our community, which is about 6,000. And by that time, dads were allowed in the delivery room. And it was a very pleasant, positive experience, but I still struggled with the fact that there was no way for me to visit my older child, nor to have my husband present with me during feedings. Our youngest child was born about 6 years ago, and at that time, again, slow but sure, we got a few more changes accomplished, and we were able to not only have demand feeding whenever we wanted it after the birth, but during the birth itself, we felt we had some flexibility in terms of structuring the environment within the delivery room. We were allowed to dim lights, and were just fascinated by how she responded with very wide eyes and focused gaze at her dad, who was busy humming away to her. You have to realize she's the first and only daughter in her family. And that, as we are now understanding, newborns do have a lot of skills that they can do right at birth. And vision is a little more sophisticated than we originally gave it credit. And we really witnessed that as she really zeroed in on dad and really participated visually with us in those early moments. And that was really neat. We had a lot of contact time with her, both right in the delivery room as well as shortly after when she was dried off and diapered and all the essentials taken care of. But I still had regrets that I still had no way to visit my two sons who were out in the waiting room. Since that time, I've continued to teach in the same community. I work with the staff at that same hospital where I had my second two children. We now are able to offer mothers not only the opportunity to visit their children at any time that are at home, but to leave the hospital early, providing their medical condition and the status of their child is okay. They can leave even within 12 hours after delivery. There is a C-section class that's designed for dads who choose to go in with their wives if there is going to be a planned C-section. And so we really, I think, slow but sure, keep adding some awarenesses and opennesses to meeting parents' wishes and needs. I'd like to widen our understanding of this new philosophy by quickly giving you just a superficial historical perspective of how childbirth has been treated or approached in America. We look back to the 1800s, we're talking about a period of time which was predominantly home births, and midwifery was very active. It had to be. There weren't that many doctors, there were too many people who were living in rural areas, and midwifery was the one support network that mothers had. In the late 1800s, in the early 1900s, we see the appearance of chloroform, and along with it came the invention of forceps. Two came hand in hand, because if you give mother chloroform, put her to sleep, she can't push the baby out, so you've got to pull it out. And so the two really came together. This also encouraged mothers to deliver in hospitals, because it's not really easy to give chloroform or use forceps in a home setting. So we found mothers shifting from giving birth at home to giving birth in hospitals. And at that time, the turn of the century, hospitals were not the easiest or the safest place to be. Sterile practices were not yet in existence, and childbirth fever was fairly common, and hospitals really were intended for the very sick. But that's where they ended up. In 1940, around that time, we have a physician named Grantley Dickreed, some of you probably have heard of him, who is really responsible for the concept and the term natural childbirth. And that's been a broad envelope term that's been really laid over, I think, most of the childbirth preparation that we've seen in the last 20 years. His contribution came through some of his own personal awarenesses as he worked with laboring mothers that, hey, yeah, really, you know, giving birth is a natural human process. That's what women's bodies were designed to do. He was working with a mother in the country one day and was trying to offer her chloroform several times through the labor and near the delivery, and she kept refusing him. When it was all over, he asked her, why wouldn't you accept the chloroform? And her response was, it didn't hurt. Was it supposed to? And so it really awakened in him, you know, I think an appreciation that was long due and coming. He supplemented the whole idea of birth being, again, a natural process with what we call passive relaxation exercises. Some groups still practice these. Basically, the idea behind it is that you use a mental image that's relaxing to you. It might be imagining yourself on a warm, sandy beach or floating in a pool of warm water. That type of relaxation approach. Despite Reed's efforts, medication during the 40s and 50s continued to rise. We saw the occurrence of twilight sleep, which is, I'm sure, something that my mother was exposed to. That's basically scopolamine, and that's an amnesiac drug. It does not put you to sleep. It does not relieve your pain. It simply erases your memory of what is happening. It's really kind of a cruel approach, I think, to the whole issue. General anesthetic became more popular, and putting moms to sleep was quite common. This, of course, again means that moms usually had forceps assist during delivery. It also meant that they usually did not see their babies for the next 12 to sometimes 24 hours. Babies were kept in the nursery because the babies were groggy. Mom was still out, and it took at least a day or two to work through the general anesthesia. Moms were in the hospital sometimes up to 7 or more days, often told to stay in bed for a week. And we saw all kinds of problems in hindsight that evolved out of those practices. The rise in this type of heavy medication, of course, parallels the dependence on doctors, dependence on forceps, and the dependence on the hospital setting. In the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, we see an attempt to pull the birth experience away from general anesthesia. We get into saddle blocks, get into caudal and epidurals, and those, if you're not real familiar with those types of medications, basically are ways to regionally numb the mom, basically from about here down, so that she can still be awake, but her perception, her sensation is gone, and with the saddle block, even her ability to move her legs is gone. There are medications that are injected in the back, the saddle blocks are injected in the spinal fluid, whereas the caudal and epidurals are injected below that area to numb the nerves that come down to the lower abdomen and legs. Some of these regional medications are still used today, but I think more and more we're seeing that they're reserved for problem deliveries. And we can talk more about that later if you want to get into that. In about 1952, a physician named Dr. Lamaze, who was French, visited Russia. And he took several tours of their labor wards and noted that the women were quiet, appeared relaxed, and that their labors progressed very efficiently as a rule. The approach that was being used in Russia at the time was called psychoprophylaxis. If you break that word down, you realize that it's saying that people are using their mind as a form of pain relief, pain prevention. He brought that concept back to France and supplemented it with several breathing exercises. And this is the basis of what we all know as, quote, the Lamaze approach to childbirth. It's had some modifications over the years, but this is basically its roots. One of his patients in the 50s over in France happened to be an American woman who was having her first child, and she took both medical care through him as well as classes and learned his approach. When she came back to the United States to have her second child, she had a great deal of difficulty finding anybody who would go along with what she wanted to try. She did find someone, and as a result of her experience and her struggles here in the States, she wrote a book. Thank you, Dr. Lamaze. It's quite well known. The author, of course, is Marjorie Carmel. It was as a result of her book, really, that got the awareness in the United States going. And as a result of women asking questions like, why can't I be awake? Why can't I do more to give birth rather than passively lie there and be delivered? My husband would like to be involved more than pacing in the waiting room. What's going on in my body during labor, during delivery, or why am I feeling these things during pregnancy? All kinds of questions that were cropping up as a result of both the impact of public awareness and these types of questions. Two childbirth organizations were formed in 1960, and their initial, for a reason, because they've got long titles, one of them is called ASPO, American Society for Prophylaxis and Obstetrics. I always say ASPO, otherwise I get my title all tied up. And the other one is initialed ICEA, International Childbirth Education Association. They are still the two major childbirth education groups in the country, and the two main groups that are certifying instructors. What we see then is the beginning of a childbirth education movement in the United States. And initially, those classes were designed to help women understand four basic areas. One was the whole physiology and psychology of changes during pregnancy. Examples of that might be helping women understand why they have certain physical discomforts, the heartburn, the swollen feet, feeling flushed and hot, backache, leg cramps, go on and on. Some of those are familiar, I'm sure, for some of you. Helping them understand some of the emotional changes, the dips and highs of pregnancy, the lack of interest in sexual activities, and we could go on. But those are some examples of areas that we're being laid open in, and people were having a chance to be more informed about. Number two were physical and psychological changes that were occurring during labor and delivery itself. And again, an example might be just helping people understand that, very basically, number one, labor is the result of contractions of the uterus. And the pain and discomfort that comes during labor is not from those uterine contractions, because the uterus is a muscle and it's designed to work like any other muscle in our body is. But the pain is coming from the cervix, the opening at the bottom of the uterus, which is expanding or dilating, we say. And that's where the pain and discomfort is coming from. That's one tiny little example that I do the first night right off the bat to help parents understand just an overview of what happens during labor, what their body is doing physically, how they're feeling emotionally, and what they can do about it. Number three, the classes were designed to give the mothers tools that they could use during labor and delivery to promote relaxation, to reduce physical discomfort and pain, to conserve their energy, and to improve the efficiency of their labor. And key tools that we still use today are things like relaxation exercises, massage techniques, breathing exercises, and pushing techniques. One note on the breathing exercises, if you've seen any of the shows on TV, some of them are written with a great touch of humor. You see this mother who's being whisked off to the hospital, who's doing a rather absurd form of, you know, either blowing or a very unusual type of breathing. And it's unusual for probably two reasons, because this goes back to some of the main theory in psychoprophylaxis, is that the breathing is not everyday breathing. Because it isn't, it requires concentration. And because breathing is tied hand in glove with your ability to relax and your very ability to be alive, it's probably the core way to get yourself distracted. And it is a tool of distraction, as well as a tool of making sure that you get enough oxygen during the contractions and that your oxygen reserve in your placenta stays up. Otherwise, women either hold their breath or scream through the contractions, and as a result get very tired, and the baby starts to show some effects as well. Number four was the whole attempt to try to eradicate a lot of wives' tales that were circulating, and I'm still doing that. I still get chuckles inside. I never show it on my face, but I still have moms who, when we do exercises the first night and I reach up toward the ceiling and I put my arms up, some of them will gasp and say, isn't that going to put the cord around the baby's neck? You know, one can make a whole list of some incredible wives' tales that get passed on. There was a piece of research in the late 60s that for the first time started to verify what the effects of these classes were doing. And that lady was Margaret Tanzer, and she wrote a book called Why Natural Childbirth. And I pulled this four of the main things out of there that she came up with in her summary that were end products of this type of preparation. One of the key ones was that women expressed an increased sense of self-esteem and self-confidence. The second one was that women tended to approach birth with a much more positive expectation and feeling level. The third one was that their perception of pain during birth was actually decreased. And I did say the word perception, and that's key, because pain is a relative thing. It's a lot of it is in how we interpret what we're feeling. The fourth thing that I wanted to mention out of that study was that the husband's involvement was crucial, and it could be a key person as well. It does not always need to be the husband, but a husband or a key support person needs to be there, needs to be part of the experience. During the 70s then, what we saw, and this is as I started to teach, was a whole network of childbirth teachers and classes that expanded. And the philosophy of approaching childbirth as not only a natural, normal, healthy bodily process, but also as a significant event for which education and preparation was extremely helpful, produced in a sense a childbirth education movement. And I use the word movement intentionally. And I think we'll understand that better as I go along. Piggybacking on some of the same issues of the human potential and the feminist movement, yet launching new critiques against the medical establishment's practices of anesthesia, medical interventions, unnecessary C-sections, circumcision, episiotomies, scheduled feedings, lack of parent-infant contact, and bottle feeding, childbirth education movement gathered rapid momentum on the shoulders of parent enthusiasm and support. What we see in the 70s then was a dramatic return to breastfeeding, a decreased use of medication, an increased husband involvement and presence throughout the birthing process, and believe it or not, an increase in physician support and use of parents' preparation as they gradually discovered that prepared parents were actually easier to work with than unprepared ones. This gave them also the opportunity to use less medication during labor and delivery, for they also were gradually discovering that the less medication mom had, the healthier mom and baby both were. In the late 70s and now into the 80s, what we're seeing are hospitals being forced by parent pressure and consumerism to really provide alternatives beyond allowing dads in the delivery room, beyond rooming in with the baby, and beyond demand feeding. Many hospitals are trying to humanize the delivery room experience by providing a baby on mom's tummy right away, nursing on the delivery bed, dim lights, other ways of softening the environment and making it less hospital-like, if that's possible. Some hospitals, especially in larger cities, have what's called a birthing room. Maybe some of you have used that kind of facility where the mom labors and delivers in the same bed. This prevents a lot of that hassle changing rooms and beds and everything else. Some have gone a step further and provide classes in preparation for older children to be present during mother's delivery and involved in that. Most hospitals are at least providing visitation of children that are at home. Many of them, as I indicated earlier, are providing early departure policies where mother and baby can leave sooner than the usual 2 to 3 day stay. And as I hinted at, what's happening in our own community, many hospitals are providing ways that dads can also participate in cesarean deliveries. Now, admittedly, some parents and groups have felt that hospitals have not changed fast enough or far enough, or they genuinely seek to return the option of home birth and midwifery as a safe alternative to hospital delivery. And we're seeing more and more of this, and I would say especially on the coast. Living in the Midwest, I have seen very dramatically, as we see about other things, that the Midwest is last to change. In Nebraska, for example, midwifery is still illegal, and that's true of many Midwestern states. It's not true of the South because it never went out of style. So it does depend on the area of the country that you're in. I think a middle ground solution has also arisen in some larger cities, and those are alternative birth centers. And those types of facilities allow prenatal care as well as labor and delivery care within that one facility. I'd like to point out too that there are many side educational issues that have spun off the whole childbirth education movement. We're now seeing groups that provide not only parent support in the form of parenting classes or just get-together groups, but also breastfeeding support groups, C-section support groups, you can go down the list, grief support groups, family planning groups, and postpartum exercise classes, and the list goes on. But a lot of these are spin-offs from the original childbirth education movement itself. I'd like to caution you that as with any movement that attempts to impact an institution or cultural tradition, there are elements of radicalism, overreaction, as well as appropriate criticisms and judgments. The same movement that has helped us rediscover how vital it is for mothers to actively give birth to their children and be supported during that time has also given us some dubious fads, such as giving birth underwater. The mistake of producing guilt in mothers who choose not to breastfeed, or who needed medication, or who had to have a C-section, has been made, along with providing the awareness that parents have opportunities to choose and enhance the birth of their child. You can't have it all. You can't have a thrust that's trying to change established practices that are pretty established in the community that occasionally doesn't go toward the radical to produce some change. I guess in summary, before I open it up to questions, I'd like to just wrap up by saying I personally feel that childbirth education has as its main goal today that of educating parents as to their options, their responsibilities and accountabilities, along with the physiological and the psychological transitions of pregnancy, birth, and postpartum, so that parents can make educated choices, can work in harmony with their body, and can use the technological medical advancements that are available to them for their own health and the health of their child. Now, I've spent the first part here really talking to you about the childbirth education movement. Sometimes that's a little dry and a little kind of up here. I'd like to give you a chance with your questions, since you haven't been gutsy enough to interrupt me yet, to either ask questions regarding the whole movement itself, or if you want to spin off and talk about what the future implications are, that's kind of interesting, or if you want to actually take this time to ask some questions about pregnancy, birth, delivery, postpartum, that whole scene that you either never had the courage to ask your doctor or never found the answers or in hindsight you've wondered about for a long time. We can go a number of different directions and think of your questions. So I'm going to give you a chance to do some of that.
Yeah. What are your personal feelings on letting siblings and children watch you or taking you?
I think there's several things parents have to consider in that whole issue. Number one is the age of their child. Number two, the sensitivities of their child. I think each child is different. Some could handle that better than others. I think the third thing is that there really has to be adequate preparation. And there are lots of good resources out to help parents do that. And in some communities there's even classes. I think I never did it personally. I didn't have the circumstantial possibility of even trying it. But from what I've read, some families report that it was just a really neat experience. That the older child felt a lot closer attachment to that new baby brother or sister right off the bat, and it removed a lot of the mystery. They weren't necessarily there the whole time. In other words, if mom happened to have kind of a rough transition, that's the period right before she's ready to start pushing, when the last little bit of the cervix is getting out of the way. The child may have been in another room, coloring, being read to, or going for a walk. Not that they're there the whole time. And then brought in during the latter part of the delivery. So there's ways to weave in and out of that experience. Some kids just will sit and read a book or watch TV, and then when it's about time, they'll take note, come over and really participate. But I can't give you a personal reaction since I haven't done it. But I think it's an issue that I certainly in class would educate parents as to resources that they can use, pros and cons, and let them choose what feels right for their own family. Some parents are really repelled by the idea, other parents are really excited about it. So it just depends on the family. And that's a good example of how not to push a new thing on everybody who goes through childbirth education. And I think that mistake has been made in the sense that couples have gone through classes and have been told, now if you want to do it the really healthy way, or the really, this is really going to be exciting for you, because it is for most people. They're, you know, everybody's a little different. And push on them that they must breastfeed the first 6 months, or they must have room again, or they must do whatever. I think that's an injustice to individual differences. And I think it's much more appropriate to tell people what's available, what their choices are, and help educate them so they can make a choice for what fits good for them. Because some moms, for example, when they have their second or third child, the last thing they want to do is room in. They want to sleep because they don't want to get home. They've got another child or two running around the house who's going to want their attention. So it really varies.
The documentary on 2020 about older children and the delivery room. Some of the kids she thought was the best thing in the world, but one little girl she felt probably 11 or 12 since she had five kids home.
And that's one of those, how do you know how they're gonna react ahead of time? I think a good, if you're gonna ever trial run that in your family, there are a lot of education programs on TV that do, on a children's level, even 5, 6, 7 years of age, take through the growth of the baby and the birth of the baby. You can get a little bit of a sense of how they might react from watching something on TV. It's still different than it's a compliment. Just as it's different for the husband who's having watched films in college than is actually with his own wife delivered. And what I experienced in that situation, I know the analogy crosses over. Many men end up going through these biology classes or whatever in college, and they put cold feet about this whole delivery business. And then they start going to classes, and they don't say much the first week or two. They'd rather not be there. They look at the floor, you know. And oftentimes, those are my most enthusiastic fathers. And they're maybe reluctant about going in the delivery room. It's an art form where she'll just kind of say, well, it's about time to change. Why don't we go here and get dressed? And kind of just goes along, and then he realizes he really is important to what's going on. Plus, it's very meaningful for him emotionally. It's his child just as much as it is the wife's. I've had many say, boy, I'm sure glad I didn't miss that. Other questions?
Do you have an opinion on the Bradley method? Do you know that we mentioned earlier?
The Bradley method is a little more closely tied to what Grant and Dupree proposed in the 40s. And their relaxation approach is a little different. I think it is, again, more of that passive type of relaxation. Personally, I found in the area of relaxation, that's not enough. For me to lie there and think pleasant thoughts after about 5 or 6 centimeters doesn't work. Now, I don't know if you've not had a child yet, what I'm talking about is, have you had a child before?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so you know what
I thought the Bradley method was the best for me. So,
and
everybody's different.
You bet. And I like to do different things with relaxation than the Bradley method does. But in terms of what breathing technique works the best, the issue is they all work. They all are designed to do the same thing. They're all designed to help you relax, to help keep you breathing, and help distract you. So if you want to do panting a la Ma style, or if you want to do phonetic sounds or choo-choos, there's, there's all kinds of variations. Some people like that they get taught the first time, and that's what they're most comfortable with. There are others find ways to simplify it, come up with kind of their own. In between, I think there needs to be that kind of room of flexibility.
studied several different ideas and theories, and so during labor we kind of tried them all. And it just felt, you know, that felt the best.
I have found over the years as I've taught, I've had to broaden my approach with breathing, because some of the Lamaze techniques are harder for some people. Fast panic is hard for some people, and so I can teach them some of the other ones. And I tell them, come up with your own, tell me what it is, so I can cast it off somebody else. Yes?
Well, it also differs between children. What works for them? One delivery will work for the other. If you have bad labor, one isn't going to work. If you don't get bad labor, some others are going to work.
And hopefully the classes that you attend will be broad enough that they can give you enough tools so no matter what you are faced with, you can roll with them reasonably well. So I usually swipe bits and pieces from all different places and put them together. Yeah.
What were some of the future implications that you mentioned?
Well, I think one of the things that I'm reading from people who are, let's say, up in front in the movement, who are pushing the hardest, okay, is a very marked increase in home births and preparation for midwifery being expanded across the country. Now, some people feel really comfortable with that, and others do not. I guess because I have a medical background, I get a little uptight with parents who jump into that approach because it sounds like a neat thing to do, or it's cheaper than the hospital. Okay? I think it's important that parents understand what they're choosing between and what they're choosing not to have available and what they're choosing to have available to themselves. Obviously, because I've got a medical background, I can be more comfortable in a hospital giving birth than a lot of other people can. And I realize that. For some people, that the importance of a family environment, their own natural home setting, people they love and know around them is crucial. And they don't function very well outside of that. And in some ways, they can be a very good candidate for a home birth. It depends a little bit on your physical history, on your prenatal history, in terms of what kind of risks you're taking. And I think parents need to be well informed what their risks are, and help them if they choose to have a home birth, have some backup systems, so that if they do end up in trouble, that as quickly as possible that they can get some assistance. I think another thing that's probably, I hinted at in a humorous way, has been on the forefront in the last year and a half, has been this whole business of getting birth underwater. I think that's really got out. I hope it does, personally. Pretty strong feelings about the fact that sooner or later the baby's going to have to come out of the water. You know, they've been in water inside of you for 9 months. And there is a point, I would think, where there's some risk of suffocation and inhaling water. That's my own personal thing. I think another thing that's on the rise is more alternative birth type arrangements, some kind of middle ground between the home and the hospital. Either that or the hospitals are really going to have to come down even more to some of the parents' needs that are being expressed. And hospitals are in a tight position these days. I know how many of you are aware, but I know a lot of, not just small communities, large cities too, are really struggling with the whole issue of just keeping their hospital afloat. Marked drop in the last 6 months in the number of patients that are using hospitals. Some they have to do with the whole thing that the government's doing with DRGs, diagnosis. The patient comes in with diagnosis and is allotted so many days diagnosis, and then they leave. And so hospitals are, in order to survive, are going to have to, I think, do even more catering. Some have tried to do that by really making a very homey looking birth room. You know, a double-sized bed and all kinds of things like that. like that, but I think there will be more clinic-type settings offered to parents and more opportunities to have children outside of the hospital. Yeah.
Have you read anything about birthing chair?
Yes, and I was trying to help our hospital staff work through that whole decision, because for the last, I'd say six, seven years, there's been a lot of parent pressure in our community to get a birthing chair. And a birthing chair, it's really just a molded hard plastic chair that has a very simplified stirrup system, which allows the laboring woman to labor and deliver in an upright position so that gravity assists delivery. And I think that's a crucial step forward. I have a gripe about the birthing chair, however, and I have a better preference. The birthing chair, being hard molded plastic, does not accommodate different body builds very well. And there are some women who simply are highly uncomfortable and can't even get into it, who just don't fit well. And so what's happened about the last 3 years is the creation of birthing beds. There's two main companies in our area that do that, Borning and Adele. And what birthing bed does is a lot of nice things, I think, because it's like a regular thick mattress size. It's wider than a delivery table. It allows a variation of positions. You can be all the way sitting upright to all the way laying down. That doctor needed to produce more medical intervention than usual. It has different options in terms of where you put your feet. The lower half of the bed comes off, and it can be used for C-sections as well as regular deliveries. And it's a lot more flexible in terms of its use. And that's, interestingly enough, that our hospital just bought 3 months ago was the birthing bed.
What do you want to cost?
It ran between $6,000 and $7,000.
That's about the most of this one.
And our hospital is about a 49-bed hospital. So you can see that's a big investment. But they also see that, I think, finally, as OB is a very important area to keep patients coming in, because then you get young families started in your hospital community. And tends to keep that business in the area. So that's what they're thinking of. And it's this whole issue of consumerism. Where do the bucks go? And we're also a community that has a GP, so they find the GP specialist issue all the time, too.
I've been doing a lot of reading, and most of what I've read says that if you are in an upright position and get the proper training and stuff, that you should rarely need a physical
trip. Yeah, but some sources will say, if a woman could deliver in squatting, that'd be the best yet, or on her hands and knees. The only problem with American women is American women are not used to squatting because we have toilets. Whereas women in underdeveloped countries do it all the time, and they have the muscle strength and the tone to handle that position. American women don't. But in terms of being upright, number one, I agree with you totally. It does make delivery usually more rapid and more efficient. And the other thing that's happening is you've got a little more weight coming down and a little more of an ability to stretch that pelvic floor, the muscles in the pelvic floor. That's been a real controversial issue, the episiotomy issue of late. And I think moms have gotten tired of being split from yay to yay and 40 stitches later, because that's one of the most common complaints of postpartum discomfort is the whole episiotomy business. And they really try to say to doctors, hey, I don't think you need to do one that big, or are you sure I really need one at all? And in our community, most of the time, first-time moms tend to end up with some degree of episiotomy, but with second, third moms, mom has stretched once already, and it's usually more stretchy the second time. You can often get by without it.
But that was with
Well, until recently at your hospital, that was with horizontal deliveries, right?
The other thing is that the mother really needs two things to help pull that off. She needs to know how to push slowly during delivery to give the tissue a chance to give and stretch. You know, you can't pop the kid out because that's when you're at a tear. She needs a doctor who's willing to take time and do perineal massage and stretching, okay, where he uses his thumbs around that vaginal outlet, massages the area, stretches the tissue as you keep pushing down. Okay, now, some doctors will say, well, I'll see how much you need, and we'll try and wait, see if you can't get by with it. But what they do is they'll stand there and they'll watch, and they won't assist.
And they won't want to wait
too long.
Right.
And whereas if they would go ahead and do some of that stretching massage and then support the bottom of the vaginal outlet with their hand as the baby comes through, that will all help minimize tearing. And it's those little subtleties that if parents can be educated on, they can discuss with their doctor, or they can find a doctor that tunes into those kinds of sensitivities. Because episiotomies are an American creation. They are not found much in Europe and in other countries. Good question. Here.
No, my doctor, though, the first time through, he said that the baby's head was really big. It's just a big head. He waited. He said, well, I'll let you stretch it some more, and so I don't have to cut you as much. But he ended up cutting me, after a while. And with the second one, he had to do it too, but it was because, he had said, because when they do, they have big heads.
Your kids.
No, yeah. is that, what you're saying, though, if he had done that, I'm not sure if he did that. I wasn't really paying much attention to what he was doing on there. But, even if they have big heads, is it possible to have
your women? You might be more likely to tear. There are some situations that you simply can't pull off in terms of getting by without an episiotomy or a rip. And one is when the baby does have a large head diameter, or is an unusually large baby, or if the baby's in a bad position. If the doctor has to use forceps to assist, let's say the baby is kind of stuck and needs to turn a little bit, or it's just a little bigger for your pelvic outlet than maybe it should be, and he needs to help a little bit, or the baby's breech, and it needs to keep the baby coming on out. If forceps need to be used, he has to do it. There's no way around that. He needs that extra room. So there are situations, you're right, that if he weren't going to clip, he would probably have torn. And their whole point is that a clean cut heals with less scar tissue than a rip. That's starting to be debated a little bit. But that's where the doctor comes from.
Question. What do you feel about ultrasound and fetal monitoring?
That's a good one. I usually keep my mouth shut on that one because I have all these moms going through classes who just have it done. Sometimes as a matter of course. Just, we'll just have an ultrasound done and make sure everything's okay. I get very nervous with that. And I guess that's because of my physical therapy background. I use ultrasound, a different frequency, true, but I use ultrasound on patients with pain. And I know that it does chemical things in the tissue. And I'm not totally convinced yet that it does absolutely nothing to the baby. I think if it were me, what I would do is if I were pregnant, I would not choose to have an ultrasound just to make sure there's one, or make sure that the due date is somewhat close to what we had guessed. But if it was an issue of we need to check where the placenta is if the placenta is down low, you can get into some serious problems in that kind of situation. They call it placenta previa. And I would be willing to have it done. What you're weighing is risks, most studies are saying there's no discernible risk to the child. There's a few that are kind of borderline. I think more research needs to be done. And it's only been in the last, I guess, 4 or 5 years that that's been such a common practice. But if it's being done to determine a condition that would put mother or child at risk, then I think it's certainly warranted, just as x-ray during labor is warranted when you're trying to weigh whether you're going to do a C-section.
There are different kinds of ultrasounds. I've had them with all three of my kids, and they were, I was told that what they heard was only 1% out of 100 of whatever audibles. And some that they do, they hear, the baby hears 90% of what, of the sound wave or whatever. Isn't there different kinds, different strengths?
I'm sure the machine, I've never, you know, since I haven't had one done for myself, haven't watched them work the dials. With any machine that uses ultrasound, you've got a regulation of the intensity. The machines, as far as I understand it, are basically the same in terms of what they're doing. The range, there's a frequency range that they would use. There's also a little ultrasound head on the portable Doptone. That's used to listen to the baby's heartbeat, and that's used in a lot of settings and often not paid much attention to. People don't realize that that's an ultrasound head as well. And that's a little different than a massive one where you're looking at the whole baby kind of thing.
I remember asking the nurse, because there was a thing on 2020 about ultrasound, but I knew I was going to have one. She said that the baby didn't hear.
I don't worry too much about hearing, because the baby's exposed to a lot of other, actually quite loud noise, depending on where we are when we're carrying them. I think I would be more concerned about tissue changes. And I'm just a real conservatist that way.
It also, like you said, depends upon why you have them. I had it for placenta reasons, so it really, like you say, you could lose your baby or find out what the problem is.
Right. And in those situations, it's crucial. You really need to do it.
What about those little things that you listen to the heartbeat with, then? Would you suggest not using them?
I think those are pinpoint. They're, you know, they're small. It's not used for a prolonged period of time. And I would not get too worried about that.
But it wouldn't be necessary, you know, like, I got the feeling that, okay, the last time that I went, I heard a heartbeat for the first time, and that was neat, and that's, I think it's good to hear it once to make it seem more real and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it sounded like they would probably do it every time I wanted to reappointment, but I don't know if, you know, if I know it's an ultrasound, I don't know if I want to do it as far as it's going to keep me.
And you have that choice. It's your exercise.
I just wanted to know what you're feeling for about the fetal monitoring during delivery day two, if they're done with the question.
You read my mind. That's just kind of the next extension of that question. Because depending on whether you have internal or external fetal monitoring, the external fetal monitoring is two belts that go around the mom's abdomen. The bottom belt has an ultrasound head in it that's the way they pick up the baby's heartbeat. The top belt has a pressure-sensitive button that monitors the mother's contractions. And the two are graphed out, and what you're seeing is the baby's heartbeat, which is quite irregular, by the way, and the mother's contractions on the bottom. And you often see a pattern kind of like that. And there's a normal dip in the baby's heartbeat when mom has a contraction. If you're concerned about the ultrasound during the fetal monitoring, I think that's an issue that you would probably get a better answer from your physician on probably than I, because I don't know how, again, it's a narrow band. It's like if you're thinking of a flashlight beam that they have to keep adjusting so that it picks up the baby's heartbeat if the baby moves around in there. I would not think that it has same implications as a global ultrasound, yet it stays on mother longer than if she's having a global ultrasound.
Have you heard any complaints just about the whole fetal monitor setup, like women and discomfort and stuff?
Not discomfort, irritated. They feel tied down. They feel like they can't move around as easily or get up. And I think in some hospitals, initially, moms were being told they had to lie flat on their back and couldn't move around because the monitor reading wasn't any good unless they got a good reading, which is true. But there is no reason why mom has to stay in one position, or especially flat on her back. That's not healthy to begin with. She should be able to have the freedom to move around, and the nurse should just readjust it. In terms of the bands being tight or actually hurting, I never heard that complaint. There are many times where I think the fetal monitor gives important data and is justifiably recommended. But the high risk pregnancy or delivery, and they need to monitor that baby to determine if mom needs oxygen or needs to shift her position or the baby's in trouble, you bet. I asked for it with my third one because I started to get a little unnerved. My first two children had that cord around their neck. And when it happens twice in a row, you start to wonder what's up. And so sure enough, the third one had it around her neck too. And
raised your arms.
Must raise my arms a lot, right? Too much exercise. But all three were very healthy, and there was no restriction of blood flow or anything. But I did it for my own peace of mind with the third one, and it was not very long. But as a routine procedure for a normal progressing labor, I don't see that it's necessary. Sometimes, in fact, it has a negative effect on the mom psychologically. And she can, just by anxiety, you know, she sees all this equipment that she's not used to, get uptight, which does things inside chemically and can, in fact, get her tense, slow the labor down. And this has been documented. You know, by the more medical interventions you bring in, sometimes the more you need, because mom has become anxious and feel at ease and worried. And so sometimes you produce the very effect you're trying to prevent with a lot of medical equipment. But I do think there are very appropriate uses for it. The one caution on the internal monitor is that the bag of water has to be ruptured, and a catheter is inserted that lies in the uterus that measures the uterine contractions. And then the cord that picks up the baby's heartbeat has a very tiny little screw, and it's screwed into their scalp. It's superficial. You know, it's, I'm sure, between a 16th and an 1/8 of an inch. It's the best way to get a good reading. And it's commonly used in larger hospitals, especially university hospitals. I hate to make that kind of generalization. I just check it out in the community you're in, if your doctor routinely uses that. Because I get real uptight with doctors who do that routinely because they are forced to break the bag of waters. And if your labor prolongs for some reason, beyond 24 hours, you're starting to bring up some other issues, like the risk of infection, and you can't send mom home once you've broken her bag of waters and try it 2 days later. You know, you're committed to finish it out.
Is there any reason to routinely give C-sections for each? It seems almost like that's what you're doing.
Some doctors are in that school of thought, that if they know your baby's breached, you're going to have a C-section no matter what. Others are a little more open-minded. The risk, of course, with the C-section, I mean with the breach, is if it's your first child, your pelvis, in a sense, is untried. They have a hunch it's maybe big enough. If they x-ray, they can measure it exactly. But with the breach, you do not want to get stuck at the end, where the baby's body is out and their head is lodged in your pelvis. You can get into a serious situation very quickly. And that baby can start breathing. The baby can have some cord damage. All kinds of things can happen. And so some doctors, especially because the public is now practice happy, are not willing to take the risk. And because C-sections are much safer than they were 10 years ago, they know they have a safe alternative up their sleeve.
which will make sure that mom and baby are both healthy. And they'll do that just as a matter of course. And I think you, in some ways, can understand where they're coming at because of all the suits in recent years. But I do think if I were in that situation, I would want to try. I would talk that over with my doctor. But ultimately, you've got to decide, is it worth the risk? So it might depend on the size of your baby, and you might try and work a way out that you have like an x-ray during labor. So he can do a pelvimetry, which means measure your bones and your pelvis and measure the baby's head. Last question, because the bell rang.
Real quick, a commentary on where you see the trend moving as far as once a C-section or a C-section.
Okay, I see the trend changing. I think that's been the practice. Many parent groups are trying to change that. They'll say, if my C-section the first time was done because my baby was breech, or my baby was posterior, which means it was turned over face down, and that's a much bigger mass to get through the pelvis, and this next baby is neither breech nor posterior and seems positioned fine, and she has a normal size pelvis. Some doctors are willing now to say, hey, I'll let you try, but you've got to have a setup for a C-section in case you need it. So you need the kind of facility that can do either one at the last minute. And I do see more doctors willing to do that and more mothers and parents requesting that option. There is a C-sec support group, by the way, a national organization that gives information and support to parents who are trying to do that, who are trying to have a vaginal birth after a C-section. Hey, thanks for all your good questions. It's time for dinner.